Okay, I promised I would walk through building the tree and how to get things running. Actually, the delay inadvertently served us because it gave me a chance to clean up a program which 2 weeks ago I would have had to say, well, you can look at it for this kind of thing, but not for this other kind of thing because it's not quite in normal form yet. And this was the text console that we had thrown together for a client, and it was like, you know, at T-minus 2 hours and you're still cleaning up, there comes a point where you have to say, okay, the risk of further cleanup is worse than the risk of saying, don't actually look at this code for a week. Like there's a point where the return on the investment is negative, and then it's time to stop. This is a lesson that certain vendors in certain states to the Northwest might do well to learn. So my personal habit is that all of my mercurial checkouts, I stick in a directory called HG that's under my home directory. I'm not going to show you the checkout because the wires aren't cooperating, or at least they weren't last week, and I would just as soon not spend your time debugging the HITS network. I suppose, in theory, I could get on the wireless network. I've never signed up and registered for it, and I don't really see any reason to do so now. It doesn't provide anything I want. Inside this tree, I've got a bunch of things. Some of which you may recognize, but the one we care about, or at least I care about, is the Kyoto source tree. And just as to get to a clean starting point, so general things about the Kyoto source tree. Kyoto/source is the top of the tree, and if you even think you've got a bad build, the first thing to try is to do a clean build from scratch, which I'm about to do the clean part. So dist clean says, not only should you knock out all of the dottos and all of the executables and all of the random turds lying around in the tree, but you should also whack all of the things that were installed elsewhere into the tree. So above this directory in the Kyoto's directory, there's a set of output directories where various bits and pieces get installed as the build proceeds. The logic of the build, can people read that? Should I try to expand the font?
Yeah.
Let me give it a try. What's that?
Control plus.
Well, I think Control Shift plus, given that it's a. But yes, thank you. Excuse me. That wasn't meant to be quite as dismissive as it came out. Is that a little better? I'm willing to try going one more, but I have a feeling I'm going to. Well, that's going to hurt later. But we'll tell you what, let's stick with that for now and see how far we get, okay? And let me bring that bottom bit up a little bit. So the general pattern here, with the exception of the build subdirectory, is that each of these directories is a separately built subpackage. The build subdirectory holds things like makefile fragments that are included from everywhere else. Okay? So the way to think about this is that the Kyoto source makefile and everything under Kyoto source build is sort of the skeleton on top of which everything else is overlaid. And the order, the other thing here that sort of violates the pattern, CCS and CCSXM logically are one conceptual package. The reason they're separated is the stuff in CCSXM is the stuff that we install with the package manager. Ordinarily, aside from, you know, your curiosity, there's no real big need to have this tree sitting on your disk occupying storage. And given just how much storage it occupies, courtesy of the Free Software Foundation, there's a lot of good reason not to have it sitting in your tree, because unless you're planning to rebuild the compiler, you don't need it. If you're on a non-RIPM-based Linux platform, you know, you might want to grab it temporarily, build your tools, and then get rid of it. There's no reason to keep it around. If it's possible to use the package-based install, that's better, because we do update those occasionally. And in fact, I recently did an update to get mTools added to the dependency set, and I've got to ping Steve Rifkin and ask him to update the lab machines. Is anybody actually planning to use the lab machines, just so I know at this point? CS418 has already been updated, and you're all welcome to that, but if you're planning to use machines in a Linux lab, I want to make sure that I ping Steve. On the other hand, if nobody cares, why waste his time? So does anybody care? Not once. Who needs a Linux lab anyway? Might as well just give all that stuff to Microsoft since they want it. On flight mode. Well, that wasn't what I had in mind, but it'll work. Okay, so CCSXEnv I keep around because I'm the poor sod who maintains the compiler. CCS, on the other hand, contains some tools that eventually they'll migrate into CCSXEnv. They're not yet quite stable enough to do so. Okay, so just to give a sense of it, remember I said that, I said that when we boot a system, there's sort of a kernel image, and then there's an object file image, an image that has all the objects that are going to get loaded. Libquiimage is the library that knows how to do low-level manipulations on the object image file. MakeImage is the tool that builds those images, and I'll talk a little bit about what happens in MakeImage today. And Capital is the language that we use for interface description. ArchInfo is largely a distraction. The reason it exists is there are a couple of facts about the target architecture that it's very useful to know when you're building an image. For example, what is the target page size? And rather than have that fact repeated in half a billion places in the tree, since the CCS tree is the part that gets built conceptually first, because you need it to build the kernel, because the kernel uses IDL files, and it uses Capital to turn IDL files into headers, so we need Capital first. So in the sort of original structure of the tree, and you'll still see this vestigially in the sys tree because we haven't fully eradicated it, all of the architecture-specific constants were published out of a file in the sys tree. That file is slowly moving here because this part has to build them, and I want it. All the architecture-specific facts that we need are actually down in ArchInfo, all the ones that Capital needs. But you don't want to have architecture-specific facts coming from two places. It's better to sort of move them all to one place. That hasn't fully happened yet, so there is some overlap. But if we were to look at ArchInfo, only if we spell it correctly, what we would see is a file that says, this is actually a file that can be loaded into MakeImage that has architecture-specific facts related to I386. And they're all very exciting. They tell you things like, where did the stack go? What's the size of the page? What's log base 2, the size of the page? Now, there's a hack, and you should know about it. The general rule for MakeImage is if you import a package of the form foo.bar, what MakeImage does internally is it turns that into a file name, foo/bar.mki. There's one exception to this statement, which is that if you import kyotos.targetinfo, this package is known by magic to MakeImage. It is recognized, and MakeImage will implicitly append the architecture-specific variant to the name. And the reason for this is you'd like to be able to write MakeImage files that can use architecture-specific facts without thereby becoming architecture-dependent. Right? You don't want to have an import of something that explicitly says I386, because then you'd have to replicate the entire MakeImage structure for each architecture, which is what we're trying to avoid. However, targetinfo is the only package for which that kludge exists. There will be shortly another one for internal use by MakeImage, which will be the MakeImage prelude, but that one you can ignore. So back to the tree. So the sort of sequence of build is that CCS gets built mostly because we need Capital to build the kernel. Okay? The next tree that gets built is the sys tree. That's the tree that holds the kernel. And let's see if I can... it's a little long for comfort. Okay. To give you a sense of what's going on in the sys tree, let me go at that another way. So this is inside sys. Arch is where the architecture-dependent files live, and that's approximately 25% of the kernel source code for any given target. Actually, that's true for x86. It would be smaller for anything else in the known universe. If you're looking for the implementation of a particular kernel capability, it's in this caps subdirectory. And the rule is one per capability type. The Kyotos subdirectory contains the public header files that are published by the kernels. These are header files that the world at large might be expected to include. And so they describe portions of the interface between the kernel and the world that aren't really captured in IDL. So for example, IDL down at the bottom relies on being able to make a system call trap. The system call trap is architecture dependent. It relies on a structure that's defined down in the Kyotos header files. There are also some other architecture-dependent factoids in there, like there's a page size header file, There's an Endian header file, a bunch of stuff that hopefully will help us with portability when the time comes. So in contrast to Kyoto's, which is basically the kernel's public header files, HAL is the hardware quasi-abstraction layer. I would like to say that we have abstracted the hardware. We have not. It would be more accurate to say that this is the place where all the nasty things that you have to deal with between the general kernel and the hardware get squirreled away. So for example, in HAL, helps if I give the correct path. You have the header that says, here's how you do atomic operations on this target machine. Here's the CPU's specific mechanisms for spinning up the second and subsequent CPUs. Here are some particular kernel types of interest that we have to declare differently for each target architecture, in particular 64 versus 32 bits. Syscall.h is a very low-level facts about how the syscall mechanism looks from the kernel point of view as opposed to from the application caller point of view. And transmap.h, we've talked about the transmap ad nauseum. There are architectures on which the transmap does not actually require any interesting implementation. For example, if you have a machine where you know, for example, you're building an embedded system, that you only have 128 megabytes of physical memory, and you've got a 4 gigabyte virtual memory, well, shit, just map it all, right? And then there's no reason to build transient maps because everything's mapped all the time with what amounts to an identity or an identity plus constant mapping. So you end up with a trivial implementation of transmap. Well, fine. The interface to transmap has to continue to exist because the code assumes that it's going to call that interface. It will turn out to have an approximately empty implementation on that platform. Things like that. So IDL is the interface definition language description of the kernel capabilities. So for each kernel capability, there's an IDL file. This is also where the documentation in the spec, such as it is, comes from. So our IDL compiler has features similar to Doxygen in that you can extract documentation from the IDL, and long, bitter experience says maintaining things in two places is infinitely worse than maintaining them in one. So the right answer is to get your docs and your code from the same place to the extent that that makes sense. It's a fine way to do things comparable to man pages. It's a lousy way to do things comparable to theory of operation descriptions, right? If there's a close relationship between the documentation and the code, then putting the docs in the code makes sense. If what you're trying to do is give a sense of overview, it's not obvious where you would put it. So we don't do that here. Kernel is what it sounds like. It's the bulk of the machine-independent kernel code. There's then, by the way, I said HAL is where the abstraction layer is between the hardware, the architecture layer, and the general purpose kernel. That's not strictly true. Just go in the HAL when we need to introduce a new header file to deal with them. We also have some procedures that the general purpose kernel relies on being able to call that are implemented by the architecture dependent portion of the kernel. Those are not declared, those often are not declared down in the HAL subtree. And the reason is, give an example. Kernink is internal header files used by the kernel for different parts of the kernel to basically agree among themselves about what an interface lives like, looks like. So here's most of the process structure. And if I go down far enough, we will find, give me another one here. HAL, void, proc syscall. Or if I get in a little more, we'll see another one. Or proc resume. So proc resume is an interesting one because that's the one that actually takes a process and dispatches it onto a CPU. Not surprisingly, that's going to involve some assembly code. You are unlikely to find its implementation in the general purpose kernel. Underscore underscore HAL simply is a marker saying if you're looking for the implementation of this procedure, look for it in the architecture dependent code. And if you were to poke around the kernel header files, you would discover a pound define that simply pound defines underscore underscore HAL to nothing. This is purely a documentation marker. So if you're trying to figure out what all of the interface is between the general kernel and the machine specific kernel, you want to look in the HAL subdirectory, but you also want to grep for all procedures that are marked with this __how marker. And basically what's going on is, typically you'll find there are one or two of these in a given header file. Process, I think, had three. It just seemed kind of stupid to create a whole nother header file that we would have to maintain that would get out of sync down in the how tree to do a couple of procedure declarations. And so often when it was something, a few items like this, we didn't. And when the system stabilizes past a certain point, it may make sense to reconsider that. Okay, now, OpStore. The kernel effectively has two contracts. There's two external interfaces that it has to maintain. One is the interface between the kernel and applications. That's the one that's described by a combination of the IDL subdirectory and the Kyoto subdirectory. And that's the one that, as an application writer, you're normally paying attention to. But the other is the contract with the image builder for bootable images. And the kernel and the image builder have to agree on the layout of objects that are going to get handed to the kernel at boot time. And turns out, there's a third piece not yet implemented, which is the object store manager. It also has to agree about the layout of objects. Basically, anything that deals with the persistence or reload boundary has to know this layout. So if you were to look in this OpStore subtree, here's what you'd find. You'd find a header file for every object that is externally serializable. Every object that has state that might have to be saved or that might have to be reloaded. So the null capability has no state. It doesn't have an entry here. Right. Kernel services generally have no state. They don't have entry here. Page has state. It's got an entry here. And essentially, what these header files describe is what the layout of the object looks like for the image builder to use. And these headers, one of the things I promised is to expose gory details. So here's one. These headers are extremely delicate. For example, they're very careful, there may be bugs, but they attempt to be very careful to make sure that those fields that are 64-bit integers are going to be 64-bit aligned even on architectures that don't actually require them. Don't you want them? Well, it turns out that if you think about these objects, you will conclude that the only machine dependencies in these objects lie in three places. They lie in the size of a page. That one we have to parameterize, but that one's not so bad. They lie in the architecture-specific register set of a process. That one, MakeImage, actually doesn't know how to manipulate. It is expected that the object store manager does know how to manipulate. So that's actually a difference between those two interfaces. The third case is differences about alignment and byte order. So if we were to dig into libcoimage, we would discover that in libcoimage, there's a C++ class that's almost but not quite an extension of the C++ IO stream logic. It has typed interfaces for writing 16-bit words and 32-bit words and words of particular sizes. And if you were to dig into the implementation, you would discover it actually keeps track of its file offset, and it introduces alignment padding as needed to get those written to the natural alignment boundaries. And it does that without regard to what the target architecture is. So the rule is, if you're looking at an externalizable object, the alignment boundaries are determined by natural alignment of the types, not whatever alignment would be native to your machine. So on some machines, the 64-bit integer can be aligned at a 32-bit boundary, and the machine won't complain. That's fine, but that's not the case for the externalizable form of a Kyotis object, partly because we want to minimize these sorts of machine problems. Some of them we can't entirely avoid. Okay? But in particular, we want to be able to run MakeImage on an x86 machine to produce an image that will run successfully on a ColdFire. And there are a few issues with that. The alignment rules are different. If I'm running it on AMD 64, they don't agree about register size. They don't agree about byte order. They don't agree about page size. And the tool basically has to encapsulate this stuff. Now, the reason I'm going through this long description is, suppose we were to go back to process.h. It would really help if I would remember to type the full path. You might at some point get in here and say, oh, well, what happened to the actual process state? What about the ability slots and the registers that are supposed to be part of a process? And what you'll discover is every one of those header files in OpStore, there is another header file in Kernig that includes it. The pattern is that the header file in Kernig will declare a structure, and somewhere in that structure there will be a field called state. And that state field is whatever structure was defined over in OpStore. So the distinction is, the stuff in the OpStore version is the stuff that is externalizable when you save the kernel or when you reload the kernel. The stuff in kerning process is all of the other state that you need to have in order to actually be running a process. So there's a lot of state. For example, stall queue pointers, right? When I'm writing a process to a disk, it is no longer interesting what stall queue the process is on, right? That state that I don't have to save. So that state lives in kerning process. Capability state of the process, I do have to save. That's an OpStore process. And frankly, you may not poke around much in this history, and hopefully you won't need to, but should you need to, I want you to know sort of what's down there. Okay, then we get to base and tutorial. So base is approximately the base system image, right? It's the kind of stuff that you'd expect to see in a minimal boot image of a system. And there's lots yet to be put in there, but not going to work either. Okay, base domain is basically primordial processes that the system has to have. So for example, base domain space bank is the directory where you'll find the implementation of the primordial storage allocator. Base domain elf space, elf process handler, elf space, is the one that knows how to build address spaces out of elf object files. Elf is the linking form. Elf is the object file format that's commonly used in Linux implementations, has been for a long time. It replaced, for the most part, the earlier 8.out format. We've adopted it for Kaietis as well. Bit of ancient history, Elf is something I actually had a hand in designing 20 some odd years ago. The constructor. I think I've mentioned at least the existence of a constructor. It's the agent that knows how to build new processes. Well, surprise, guess where the implementation of that is. You might wonder about constructor I3v6, and I'll come back to that one. IDL is the interface definitions for the objects that are getting implemented in the domain subtree. And lib is a small piece of runtime library that's still evolving. Doesn't actually have much in it. It basically has the implementation of sbreak. One thing you won't find in the base tree is libc. Libc is being implemented by something called newlib, and that lives down in the CCSXN tree. Newlib is a portable implementation of libc, where basically it assumes that you will provide implementations of a short list of system calls, I think like 10. Okay. And in due course, base lib runtime will implement things that simulate those 10 system calls. You know, what are they? They're things like sbreak, right? Because you can't build malloc in the Unix style without sbreak. Things like isattty, so that the standard I/O system can determine how it should do buffering. Things like that. There's a short list. And then there's a test subtree, which is what it sounds like. Okay. So if you want to make this tree, you know, sort of from nothing, the first step is the one that I did a minute ago, which is to say make dist clean in, sorry, I should show you where I am, in Kaietis source. So that'll go and basically whack everything. And then before I actually build the tree, notice that in the directory above this, which is Kaietis, at the moment, the only thing we have is source. When we're done with the build, we're going to have lots of stuff floating around there. Contrary to a lot of other systems, you do not proceed by typing make install in this tree. That will invariably get you into trouble. Because the pattern is there's an order to the build, and the assumption is that each package gets built as a unit. So often, there are pieces of the build that assume that earlier pieces of the package have already been visited for rebuild. So the rule is if you type make in the Kaietis source directory, it rebuilds everything. If you type make down in a given subdirectory, it rebuilds only that package. The assumption is you're working on that package. If you're uncertain what state you're in, go up to Kaietis source, make dist clean, make. This will not be as painful as you might expect because you notice all of these things are prefixed by called a ccache. Ccache is this wonderful little tool that says, oh, if the input is the same one that I saw last time, supply the output that you got last time. This is wonderful. It's compilation without the compile step. And it cuts the build time from tens of minutes down to about a minute or two. Now, of course, sometimes you get an error. But what? Okay, what did I do to myself? All right. Well, okay. That shouldn't be right. Because I know that used to build. See if I can figure out what's going on here. Oh, well, this is a work in progress. Perhaps we should turn it off. I surprised you that I was in the process of implementing a domain that might serve as a hint for the upcoming assignment. That was it. But apparently it wasn't implemented enough. So let's see if we can get past it. Okay, some unbelievable number of makes later, we start building the documentation tree. Since I'm not really interested in building the documentation tree right now, I'm just going to say stop. We probably ought to change the default. We sort of our habit is to say, look, you should build everything in the tree every time, because if you don't, you will fall into the habit of not building everything in the tree most of the time, and then you won't know if the tree actually works. The problem with this is that LaTeX is not your friend, and there's absolutely no way to speed it up that we have been able to find. And we have a whole build system that very carefully generates documents in both paper and HTML form. So, here's how to beat it. Add the optional DIRS equals quote quote, or there's actually a way to say, look, only build the HTML output. The HTML output build is decently fast. And I will send out a note about both of those. But just to make sure we got a clean build, let me suppress the doctree build. We'll probably flip this around and add a make world target. Okay, so at this point we have a tree build. Okay. Now, it turns out that in the course of building this tree that we actually have built a kernel image, because we compiled down in the sys tree, and that lives in sysarch i386 kernel build Kyoto, something like that. General rule is outputs in a given directory will go in a subdirectory named all caps build. We try not to clutter the source directories. We don't always succeed. We also generated some image files. Okay, so what's here? Test.textconsole.c. I love the fact that everything down in the test tree starts with test, as if you didn't already get the idea. We probably should rethink that. Is a small program that basically knows how to start up a text console, which will then run. Now, the text console at the moment doesn't do anything very exciting. It maps the MDA frame buffer. For those of you who've never seen an MDA frame buffer, that's the text mode display that the BIOS does its advertising with. And it prints some text there, mostly to prove that we can. This will shortly be converted over to use the stream interface, so it will actually supply the output half of the terminal. Okay, so let me walk through what the test program is doing, because that's actually reasonably explainable. So in order to create the text console, what are we going to need? We're going to need to supply a source of storage from which that program will bootstrap itself. And we also have to provide an authority to execute instructions, namely a schedule capability. In this case, what the test program is going to do, sort of, I see you laughing in the back. Is there something I missed? Because, I mean, it's okay. I'm just curious. Okay. So in this case, what we're going to do is we're going to extract our own schedule capability. How the test program got that, I'm going to come to in a minute. Suffice it to say that it has one, and it's basically going to just share it with the text console. So it's going to extract that into a temporary capability. And I should go up and point out that very important to pronounce the underscore carefully. In this case, it's merely allocating a bunch of temporary registers for internal use. Those of you who are not clear about the pronouncing the underscore part should try pronouncing this to yourself at home later. Okay, so it's going to grab out a schedule capability into a temporary register. And it is going to go to the space bank and say, I want a subbank that's going to be the source of storage for the text console. Let me explain the subbank bit. So banks are arranged in a hierarchy. And from a bank, you go and allocate pages and GPTs and processes and lions and tigers and bears and things like that. It was Halloween at the zoo this last weekend, so lions and tigers and bears are fresh in my mind. And the problem is, suppose you have a process that goes off the rails somehow, and you'd sort of like to get rid of it. If it isn't talking to you, it is difficult to ask it to destroy itself. And assuming you did ask it to destroy itself, it's not clear that it would agree, because after all, it's misbehaving. That's why you're asking it to destroy itself. So the ultimate last resort, in Unix, what you would do is you would say, well, kill minus 9 that damned offending process. Well, we don't have signals in Coyotes, and you may not even be able to name the process. Root may not even, there's no root in Coyotes, right? Sort of the analogous behavior in Coyotes is you destroy the source of storage from which the process was created. So when you destroy the bank, one of the things you can say is, get rid of the bank, and kill all the storage that's been allocated for this bank, including any subbanks. It's what? When the process data structure goes away, the process will cease to execute instructions. I promise. So this is sort of the way to pull the ripcord when a process has gotten out of control, is you destroy its storage. There is currently a bug in the kernel which will cause a kernel panic if you actually do this, because the kernel doesn't really know how to deallocate processes correctly at the moment. So we're creating a bank from which, in principle, we could pull the ripcord on Text Console. Now I'm going to go to the constructor of Text Consoles, which we have in this CRCTOR register, and I'll explain how it got there in a minute. We're going to say, well, create a Text Console. Now, Text Console is a funny case, because you'd normally expect that there would be only one of these in the system. There's no really compelling reason to use a constructor to build something when there's only going to be one instance of that something. The reason we do it anyway is mostly because having everything use the same runtime initialization code just makes life simpler. It's less to think about. And fabricating a constructor for the thing basically doesn't cost very much. The constructor has a protocol that it uses to create new processes. The low-level runtime code expects to be invoked with that protocol. So in this case, the constructor is actually completely unnecessary. We're using it for convenience of runtime. Now, when this call returns, CR yield holds a capability to the new text console. It's a little dicey, so let me explain what happened. The test program sent a message to the constructor. The constructor fabricated a text console, which got a chance to do whatever initialization it wanted to do. The text console is the one who replied. Not a call return protocol. The primitive messaging system does not require a call return protocol. The reason for this is you would like it to be the case that you get a capability back after the program is actually ready to do business. Furthermore, you might want to instantiate programs where what that first program does is initialize something else, return to you the something else, and then exit. The constructor has no idea what that something else might be. The contract is when you invoke a constructor, it will kick off a process, and that process will return some capability to you. What capability depends on what process you kicked off. Okay, so message now saying, construction is completed. So at this point, we have a valid text console instance. It has gone through its initialization code, or as much as it cared to. And now we're going to print a couple of things to the text console to see if it's listening. None of which is terribly exciting. And the for loop is working around a temporary bug in the runtime where if you make the mistake of returning from main, you currently take a process fault, and that's just a mistake. Fixed. It can already have been fixed, but it wasn't at the time this code went into the tree. Want to run it? Or actually, before we run it, so in the build subdirectory, there's the .o file, which is the thing you normally get from a C compilation. There's the executable file, which you'd expect to get, I hope. And there's this makeImage.out. So what about makeImage.out? That's also something that needs some explanation. Okay, the MKI file, this is what builds makeImage.out, or at least this is what makeImage.out gets built from. So, an MKI file is a system image file, or it's a complete system image. And the way you build one is you tell makeImage, I want to build a system image, and that system image should be sure to include certain modules. That's a module. And this is a module that in order to do its thing needs some other modules. Right? It needs the runtime support, it needs the image loader for binary images, it needs a way to build a boot process because the test tool is a A boot process is a process that's running at the system startup time. The test agent is a boot process. It has to be running at time zero. And it needs whatever it is you need to have to actually instantiate a text console. I'm going to come to that in a minute. And it's not very exciting. It says, okay, let me make a new bank. And I'm going to, because generally speaking, you don't want to fabricate things from the prime bank. Let me load a new image, which is the binary for the test application. And when I load that image, I'm going to build a tree consisting of pages and GPTs. This module is interpreted by MakeImage. Pages and GPTs that contain that image are going to be allocated from this bank. That's what the bank argument is saying. So think of this as a system in which you had multiple heaps. So you have to specify which heap the storage is coming from. That's actually a pretty good analogy for what's going on. Given that I've loaded the binary image into sort of Kyoto's terms, now what I want to do is I want to make a boot process, BP, because I renamed the module up here when I imported it. I want to fabricate that. I want to get the storage for that new process, again, from this bank. I want that process to run the image that I just loaded. And then the last two arguments here are process fault handler that I want to use. In this case, we don't have one. And the extra runtime capability that I want to pass, and we haven't actually worked that out yet, so we don't have one of those either yet. Right, now I've got a process that, assuming I were to write this image out to memory, because of course MakeImage is doing this all in memory, but assuming I write it out to disk, I would have a running process, except that this running process does not have any interesting ability to do anything, because it doesn't hold any capabilities of interest yet. What I've done so far with this bp.make is I've established a process structure in which the address space slot is filled in with the image, the schedule slot is going to get filled in, that's about it. So in order for this text console to do anything, I have to give it some capabilities. In this case, this is a one-off program, so I'm not going to do the usual mechanism for that. Basically, what I'm going to do is, okay, in application register 0, what I want to do is I want to give it a capability to the constructor for the text console. That's the one that it's going to invoke to fabricate the text console. Then in the second application register, I want to give it a kernel log capability so that it can tell me what's going on. This gives it the authority to write to the kernel log. In this test case, we're not a whole lot bigger. We would have introduced an enumeration and we would have given these things proper names. In this case, we were just lazy. Before I go on and run this, let me show you the corresponding MKI file for text console. Okay. It's a little bit
wrong directory.
The text console needs a bunch of the same things that the test case did. It needs the basic runtime support. It needs to be able to, I don't know if it's actually using boot process anymore. That might be stale now. I hope it's not. Okay, it needs target info because it actually needs to be able to build a space. This is a slightly complicated test case, and I wish we had a simpler one to show, but let me walk through it. It may even be that it's no longer using page L2G. Okay, history of this test case. Going down into the tutorial tree, you will see several progressive versions of Text Console. The first version was just built as an initially running process, and I was using it to test whether we can actually successfully map physical memory. Progressive versions converged on the one here. And you can see the evolution where I got closer and closer to the normal runtime mechanism, and finally I converted over to the constructor version, which is here. I'm a little concerned that in the process I may have failed to delete some things here that should no longer be here. Okay. Now, several weeks ago, I said, well, I invoke a process with an entry capability. In addition to the message, it gets two pieces of information. It gets the endpoint ID, and it gets the protected payload. The usual convention would be that the endpoint ID is telling me what object got invoked, and the protected payload is telling me permissions. Well, this means I have to define a protected payload, at least one. So in this case, I actually don't have any interesting permissions to deal with, and so the only protected payload we need is a generic one, and that's what this enumeration is doing. Now, the reason we put it in an enumeration, there's no actual need to do that, but in MakeImage, if you say export enum, a couple of things that you can export, one of them is an enum. There's a mode in which you can run makeImage in which makeImage will produce a header file that contains those definitions. And you really want the program and makeImage to agree about things like protected payload values. So it's good to have one place to define them. So that's what's going on here, and that's the only reason this enum is here. We also have some conventions about how Text Console is going to use its register set. So its capability registers. So there's a list of leading capability registers that are essentially reserved for use by the runtime. In principle, you could overwrite them, but you probably don't want to. The runtime package tells us which the first register that's available for application use. And that's rt.reg.app0, which is why the enumeration is starting there. And the remaining entries are saying, well, this is how Text Console wants to use its application defined register set, right? It's going to need one for its own address space internally. It's going to need something called the physical range capability because it needs to map a range so that it can talk to the display. It also has the kernel log capability because this is still very early code and we're still testing. Ordinarily, we don't just hand the kernel log out to anybody. And it's going to need some temporaries. And in spite of the comment about for later, we now are using the tool enum. Okay, kind of convention here. If we were going to create just one text console, it'd be pretty easy to say, look, just put what it needs in its registers. In fact, we want to be able to instantiate multiple text consoles. Now, perhaps this is a contrived statement in this example, but in general, if we're using a constructor, we want to be able to instantiate multiple copies of whatever it is that it builds. Certainly, there are lots of instances of elf spaces in the world, address spaces. All of those instances have the same set of utility capabilities. So every copy of Text Console is going to need access to the kernel log, goes the story. So rather than have 15 billion copies of those capabilities, the convention is that if I'm a constructor for a foo, whatever the foo application is, I hold a capability page that's referred to as the tools page. The entries in that capability page are whatever utility capabilities the process needs to have in order to do whatever it is that it does. So if a process needs the kernel log capability, we're going to give it to it in the tools page. The process needs access to some other constructor. When we set it up, we're going to put that in the tools page. Any process that comes out of this constructor is going to get the same tools page, identically the same tools page. It will get a read-only copy of the tools page. We can pull things out of the tools page, but it can't write things to the tools page. So what we're going to see, if we look at the text console code, is we're going to see that one of the things that it does very early in its initialization is it's going to pull things out of the tools page and put them into application-specific registers where they are potentially useful. That'll be a very common pattern in things that use constructors. Well, the rest of it's actually pretty vanilla. Make a new bank. This is going to be the bank for the constructor. Let's load an image, which is the text console image, and I would say for the moment, ignore load small. That's actually an error. It should be load. Create a new tools page. Populate that tools page with the tools that we need. And the slots that we're going to store them in, we've previously declared in this export enum, and the reason we declared them in the export enum is later when we write the C code, we want to know what the slot numbers were. We're going to get them by exporting this enum to a C header file. And then use the constructor module to fabricate. There's a procedure in the constructor module called make. Make is the one that knows how to fabricate constructors. So what we're going to do here is we're going to fabricate a constructor for the text console. That's going to return us a capability which we are going to bind to this identifier constructor. Export here means something a little different. Generally speaking, export always means whatever symbol is getting bound, that symbol is exported from the current module, meaning it can be referenced from other modules. Export enum is unusual in that we are prepared to emit header files for those as well. So you may remember that in test text console, there was a step where it said, let me invoke tc.gov, where it said, put tc.constructor in a register. This is tc.constructor. The test text console imported this module. The side effect of importing a module is that the module gets executed the first time it's imported. That's how this variable got defined, by the execution. And then once it was defined, we were free to reference it. So the way we built the system here was that this MKI file, which was the test one, drove by import, pulling in all of the other pieces that we needed. And the end result was that we got this file makeimage.out. So what happened was makeimage, the program, processed the MKI file, executed all of the imports starting with test.textconsole.mki, built up a memory data structure which was a bunch of these vectors, right, and then spewed these vectors out into a file which we're later going to load with grub. Let's see if I bothered. Okay, so you can see that there's a mechanism here for building makeimage.out in the makefile, which is what happened when we did the clean build. So let's run it. I'll dig into the koi pimu script in a moment. This is actually something that's not in the tree. It should be. It's a private script that I've built for basically my own use, and I'll walk you through what it does, but it's not very exciting. Watch, this is the part where the demo breaks. Okay. Part of the reason I use koi pimu is we're still doing a lot of debugging, so we basically want a debugger to come up all the time. And most of what koi pimu does is do just the right amount of delay that the debugger gets in at the right point in time. And you'll see that it's placed a breakpoint at this funny hex number, which I happen to know is the first kernel mode instruction that gets executed after grub. I'm not very interested in watching grub execute. Let's just continue there. Okay. Okay. And now we've actually, the reason we've halted is we've stopped again. Let me just continue again. Now, unfortunately, if Quimo has a way to grow the font size, I don't know what it is. If somebody knows, I'll be more than happy to do it. Is there an easy way to get Quimo to run a bigger font that anybody knows? Okay. Well, let's not get too excited about it. Let me just read it off to you. Achtung, das Maschine ist nicht für der Fingerpocken und Mittengraben. Es easy schnappen der Springenwerk, blowen Füßen und poppen Korken mit Spitzen sparken. Das Maschine ist digging by Experten only, ist nicht für geworken by das Dumpkoffen. Das Rubberneck and Sightseeing keeping this cotton picking hands in this pockets. Relaxing and watching the blinking lights. It's a very, very old joke. And then you'll see those few prints that the test console was doing. The never mind, but furthermore, the plea is self-defense, a line from a Monkees song that went off the air before any of you were born. And actually, I've cheated in that. I should also explain a bit about who owns the console at what moment. The kernel owns the display until it goes to dispatch the first application code. And the assumption is that the display driver is application code, and once we dispatch an application, we have to assume that the display driver may have been initialized, and the kernel has to stop thinking around with it. In this case, for debugging purposes, we've actually cheated. There's an unholy collusion between Text Console and the kernel. Text Console has agreed not to mess with the bottom three lines, and the kernel temporarily has agreed to mess only with the bottom three lines. We're going to take this out shortly because there's a bit of hair in GDB that you can use to basically dump the kernel log without this mechanism now, so we no longer really need it. But what's happened here? Well, I didn't actually show you TextConsole.c, but what it did was went and fetched those capabilities out of the tools page, in the space bank, it bought a GPT and rearranged its own address space. It acquired pages corresponding to the physical locations of the MDA display, and it wrote to those memory locations, which is how you write to a display buffer on a PC. This, needless to say, is not pretty. Oh, you thought that was all done in a library. No, the library, at some level, the bits actually have to get to the buffer. And this is the level where that happens. So what this demonstrates is we can map known locations in physical memory. We can do cross-process procedure calls because we did some, right? That bit up at the top was actually written out of the germglish, was written out of the initialization code of Text Console. But the bit down here, these four other lines, were written by the test by calling Text Console and saying, please write this stuff. So we've demonstrated that we can do IPC. We've demonstrated that we can do physical memory mapping. We've demonstrated that at least some of the time the IDL compiler emits something vaguely approximating the right thing. We did find a bug in the kernel path that we had to fix to make this work. In fact, we were very puzzled because the single character cases all worked correctly, but the longer string did not. It turns out that if you're copying data from one process to another, It's very important to copy it to the right location. What happens if you put it someplace else is, well, up for grabs. And we had an offset computation in the kernel path that was simply wrong. I'm not quite sure what we overwrote, and I'm glad we didn't. I think I'm glad we didn't find out. I do know that what we overwrote was an application code, so the kernel wouldn't have cared, but you might have. Okay, so let's dig into Text Console. Parts of it that I don't want to go into in gory, hairy detail, I'm going to walk through them briefly. What I mostly want to show you is Text Console is a kind of a server, right, in the sense that it responds to requests. The requests are of the form, put the string on the display, clear the tube, you know, something like this. And the piece of code I want you to see is how one goes about implementing such a thing. Because if I'm the caller, you actually saw, I don't know if I sort of went past them quickly, and I'll be happy to pull them up again. For the test case side, it just looked like a procedure call. That procedure call called what has to be one of the world's ugliest inline procedures. And there's a reason we have an IDL compiler. You don't want to write these things by hand. Unfortunately, on the receiving side, those things have to be converted back into useful procedure calls in the receiver. And there's some dispatching that has to be done and has to get exposed. Because the compiler doesn't know how many interfaces your server is implementing. IDL compiler doesn't know that. So there's a mode, you can run the IDL compiler that says, generate a template for me that implements, that dispatches the following five procedures. One piece the IDL compiler does not know is which endpoint IDs and protected payloads go with which interfaces. There's a call that it stubs out that you have to implement to do that. It then implements the world's ugliest switch statement so that it can figure out what method was invoked. It will figure out how to extract the arguments for you. And it will call a handler procedure whose arguments look very much like the one you declared in IDL. But you've got to write the handler procedure. So let me show you what that looks like. Any questions about this before I... Right. Let's look at what was the interface to Text Console. Very exciting. How to put a character. It knows how to put a character sequence. It knows how to clear the display. It also inherits some methods from the base cap interface. So Coyotes.cap is roughly, oh God, I hate to say anything that's comparable to anything in Java, but I'm going to. It serves roughly the same role as Java.object. There's a very short list of common protocol that you want everybody to implement. The two big items are destroy. I really like everybody to agree on what the method call for destroy looks like. And what do you claim your type is? It would be really bad if you had to know the type in order to ask what the type was. So those two methods get inherited from coyotes.cap. But basically what you're seeing here, it looks kind of like C code with the caveat that in contrast to C code, the meaning of long is precisely defined. A long is a 32-bit quantity, period, full stop. So this is not C code, this is IDL code. And each of the types has a specifically defined size. With that caveat, the other difference you're going to see is, lo and behold, all these methods are part of an interface. There's a single inheritance mechanism for interfaces. And occasionally, you'll see somebody declare a method and says, oh, by the way, this method can raise this here exception. One of the exceptions that's universally raisable is, out of space, brother. Right? I can't do whatever you wanted because I was unable to allocate more storage to do that. All right, let's look at the implementation of this. Let me look first at the client side. Do not recommend that you look at this stuff too closely. It's been known to cause cancer in laboratory rats. But you know, you should see why you shouldn't see this. Okay. These wonderful files can be included from either assembler or C code. Needless to say, the assembly doesn't get the C part. The important parts are for every method that appeared in the interface, you will see a pound define. And this pound define is telling us what's the method number. Okay, so each of those methods gets cryptographically assigned a method number. Why cryptographically? because it basically immunizes us to ordering changes in the IDL file. You can reorder the methods without anything changing. The downside of this is it is impossible to build an efficient dispatch mechanism across randomly selected numbers. This is why when people write switch statements, you will notice the numbers are often densely packed. That allows you to do table lookup. Well, we don't know a mechanism. In fact, there doesn't appear to be a mechanism in the world that will get us both dense numbers and non-colliding numbers. The non-colliding part is real important. Okay. In addition, for each of the methods, you're going to get the world's second ugliest union. The ugliest one is on the server side. This union is the canonical system call union. And this is the union that you can hand to the system call stub wrapper that will actually invoke the trap mechanism, with the caveat that in a couple of places, some versions of this union will actually have the argument numbers, labels re-encoded. So, if I can find an example, this might not be one. Well, Clear didn't have any arguments, so there was nothing to do. Okay, and here is a procedure, not the thing you would have gone looking for in a header file, perhaps. A static inline procedure, which means that GCC will inline it if it damn well feels like it. We've since figured out how to tell GCC that no, this is really not optional. And we've seen cases, unfortunately, where inlining these things can cause register problems, and we're still sorting out those. It's really quite wonderful what GCC will get wrong if you turn the optimizer off. But basically, what this procedure is doing is it's taking what you wanted to think of as a C call, C procedure call, and it's doing all the marshaling logic to turn this into a message structure. I make no claims to this marshaling being efficient yet, only to it being operational. So it says, okay, I'm going to take that param structure. The opcode we're invoking is the opcode that corresponds to the method, which in this case was clear. We're invoking some object, right? There's an invoked capability, so we want to actually capture that. We're going to have to supply a reply capability. That comes from our environment, our IDL environment. And we're going to have to specify an endpoint ID on which the reply is going to come in. Never mind about that for now. ICW, you may have noticed in the specification there are about 15 billion options to invoke capability. Well, this is the ones we care about for this invocation. That's 14 billion in a lot of minds more options than one might wish there were. And we're going to do the invocation. Now, if the invocation, that has two possible outcomes. Well, in this case. Well, precisely, there are two possible outcomes for the reply. One is, we get back a reply that says, all went well. I'm replying according to what the reply type of the procedure is. So the way to think about this is there's a send structure and there's a receive structure. The send structure is all of the input arguments to the procedure. The receive structure is all of the output arguments from the procedure, and those include the return value, which gets tucked around at the end of the structure, and anything that's marked as an out parameter. Those of you who don't know what an out parameter is should shoot Scott Smith for failing to teach the programming languages course in a historically respectful way. Essentially, it's a way of saying, this thing's another return value. Don't shoot Scott Smith. Or at least don't acknowledge that it was my idea. I don't know, actually. Well, what?
You're being recorded,
yeah, it's too late. I'm already... You know, I'm tempted to go a little further than play with it, and given that I'm on tape, I'm just going to stop. Okay, the other possibility is that the receiver said, oops. Oops translates as there was some excuse for not doing what you asked it to do. We refer to this as an exception. C++, we would actually turn this into an exception at the language level. C is blissfully missing that feature, and so the best we can do is return a bad result code. So what happens in the C header file, this is the C header file, is you call invoke capability, and if it returns false, you've got back an exception code. In the current IDL definition, there's only a code. There's no argument that goes with an exception. You simply raise an exception by name. There is an opcode for each exception, but there are no fields. The IDL definition, in principle, allows you to find structures that go with exceptions. Our implementation doesn't actually implement that. We have yet to find a use case for it. If you're out of space, what more could I tell you that would help? Okay, so if the result was exceptional, the problem is, of course, that we didn't want the, this is exceptional in two senses, right? It's exceptional in the sense that you didn't get the outcome you wanted, but it's also exceptional in the sense that this isn't going to happen very often. So rather than screw up the payload of the invocation of the procedure call to add more arguments to it to return back this exception code that you're almost never going to get, what we do instead is patch it into the IDL environment. So let me explain the IDL environment. There are a few things that the IDL subsystem has to know in order to make a call. It has to know the endpoint that you're going to give the other guy, actually the entry capability, no, the endpoint that you're going to give the other guy, that they're going to reply to you on. Because the primitive mechanism is a one-way send. It has to know the endpoint ID of that endpoint because that's the endpoint you're going to wait on. Those are, in effect, input parameters. As a practical matter, unless you're writing a multi-threaded process, you will have one reply endpoint, it will have endpoint ID 0, and that's the end of it. Because there's no really good reason to dink with that unless you're doing something unusual. The other thing that's in the environment structure is a field where the error code can get shoved in the event that we get one back. Also, on the server side, a field where the protected payload that's going to come in on the server side can get put so the server can examine it. Under normal conditions, the client is not going to look at any of this. It's set up the data structure at the start of the world, and it's never going to touch it again. And I mean, when I say it's never going to touch it again, there is, by strong runtime convention, it's not reserved in the kernel sense, but it might as well be, there's a particular capability register. If you don't stick your reply endpoint there, you're not going to get any replies. That endpoint ID 0 is a pretty strong convention, too. It's not a law, but it might as well be a law. And if you have a process that runs long enough to overflow the reply counter, which is 32 bits, that's a lot of procedure calls across the process boundary. Call me if that happens. There should be a check for overflow. We don't bother. It's actually not strictly necessary. So what typically happens on the client side is you declare one of these things at the start of the world, you do a static declaration of its values, and you thereafter ignore it. In fact, we may even have a default one declared down in the runtime library for you. I'll have to check. If you did not get an exception, we're going to populate the protected payload field and the endpoint ID field merely because this is the convention. Actually, on the client side, you're probably not going to look at those. Why did you do that then? Oh, this is in case you cared about checking for rollover. And we return true, indicating that this call has succeeded. So the horrible problem about C not doing exceptions is whatever you thought the return type was, we had to make that an out parameter because we had to hijack the return value so you could check for success or failure. This is the air no problem, right? The Unix pattern is every system call returns minus one or some suitably out of band value, the consequence of which is you have to go check for air no. Air no then is a nightmare because nobody stopped to consider that there might be more than one thread, right? And that forced people to invent thread local storage and to put AirNo there. It also created various kinds of races because AirNo can get overwritten before you check. So hint, if you observe C code making a system call and not checking the return value, it's a bug. There are a few rare cases where there are sequences that you can get away with doing that on because you know that if the first one makes an error, the rest of them won't work and then you can check at the end. One of the things that's unfortunate about the Unix interface is it doesn't have a very precise contract about the stability of AirNo. So if open gives me an error, and I get back minus one as my file descriptor, and then I call read passing minus one as my file descriptor, what's the impact on AirNo? Not defined. Right? There's a list in the man page of what AirNo's read might return. But there's not a very clear statement of under what conditions that might occur or whether the AirNo results are stable across calls. The answer in general is they aren't. Okay, so I wanted you to see what the client-side stuff looks like. Having seen it, my recommendation is that you not look here again lest you go blind. Okay. Pop up and look at the text console code. Okay. Remember I said that the make image tool will extract those enums for you, okay? These names over here on the right are what it extracts. Right? These are fully qualified mangled names, and you know, in the sense that Java gives you these impossible long names and you end up buying a wider terminal so that you can program. Same problem here. The reason these pound defines exist is that we want to actually be able to write code in a bounded number of columns. And I don't know about you, but I find typing these things over on the right to be near as damn it impossible. So we rename them. That's what's going on here. Nothing hugely exciting. The convention is that we use CR for capability register identifiers and tool for tool page slots. Again, nothing hugely exciting. Okay. There's an interface union. I'm going to come back to that because I want to show you another piece of this first. Let's skip down to the initialization code. Okay. Remember in the test case, the pattern was you saw a sequence of calls to check. That was actually a macro. Macro was if not call, go to fail. Something equally illuminating. Actually, it was a if not call, then it made a call to kernel log to tell you which thing had failed. We haven't yet updated this. What's going on here is that I was experimenting with a different convention. So the pattern here is, look, if you don't get all the way through your initialization, there's no point going any further. You can't do anything useful. Right? So the pattern that you would normally expect to see in initialization code is a big Boolean gather where you're testing in sequence each of the steps you require for initialization. Look, if any of them stop, you're done. Unless you have some way to recover, which is very unusual. Okay. So basically the idiom is, unless all of these things succeed, at the bottom we're going to have a what to do if I fail. So what does this thing do? This particular application needs to poke hardware I.O. registers. And for that purpose, it needs to define an I.O. space. And these first two calls are basically grabbing the I.O. permissions capability out of the tools page and sticking it into the per process I.O. space register. It's like a process has a data address space and has an I.O. address space. The second bit here is saying, oh, well, I'm going to need to allocate some pages that correspond to known physical addresses. Let me extract the FizzRange capability and put that in a capability register where I can invoke it directly. Now, the next bit of this is very mildly interesting. This is a funny case, and it's many drivers have this property, and not many other pieces of code have this property, that they have to explicitly manipulate their own address spaces. So when Text Console comes into the world, it does not have a map on the MDA frame buffer. It has an address space that contains its code and its data. It has a stack page that's been allocated by the runtime system. It doesn't have a mapping for the frame buffer. So what it needs to do is basically rearrange its own address space. So if we were to look at it, what we would discover is that at time zero, it has a GPT which has a couple of pages under it. These are text and data. And what it's going to do is buy a new top-level GPT and insert it. And it's going to basically reach up into its own brain, you know, carve the top of the head off, extract the brain and replace it, and keep executing. For those of you who haven't gone through a brain replacement before, this is a little delicate. Because very important that at the moment that you exchange the brains, the new brain has all the same state at all the same locations as the old brain. If not, you might imagine you would get confused. For example, if we were to swap my brain into Swarup's head, he would be really confused. He would inherit all of my confusion, and that would be horrible. So, what's going on here is we're calling AlecGPT. AlecGPT is a helper procedure that sets a couple of, it's just above, it's a three-line procedure. It basically says, go to the space bank, get me a GPT. Let me just show it to you. Go to the space bank, buy a GPT, set its L2V value, which describes the height of the trees underneath it, set its L2G value, which describes the height of the tree above it, and then, assuming we succeeded, return. And mostly it's that we want the combination of these things and we needed a temporary. So that's what this AlecGPT call is doing. Having allocated it, we then take our current address space and put it into slot zero of that GPT so that we're building this tree as we go. So we're basically going to extract our own, we're extracting a pointer to our brain actually. Inserting it in slot zero of the new GPT. And then we're going to take the new GPT and put it back into our head. And this may be a little different from MMAP. Okay? Here, the manipulation of the mapping structures is explicit, and processes can do it themselves. Protection in this system comes from the fact that you could only insert capabilities that you had. What happened under the covers is up to the point where you reset your brain, the kernel really didn't care about any of this. None of it was terribly interesting. Right? The minute you changed your brain, the kernel threw away your old mapping structure and started building a new one from on demand. It turns out that in all of the previously defined locations, the new space points to the same pages because we constructed it that way. All right, why did we buy this parent space? Well, we bought this parent space basically because we need to map the physical address range B0000 to BFFFF. Why? Because that happens to be where the PC put the frame buffer. So we do that, again with the alloc-gpt, and here's another helper function, insert phys pages. Very exciting, just inserts 16 physical pages at the right slots. We're actually doing it for the whole legacy frame buffer here. And then now we've got our address space set up. The last piece we got to do, and normally this is the convention for drivers, we have to arrange to have an entry capability on which we can be called. Now, the normal constructor startup fabrication protocol has already given us an initial endpoint on which to be called. It has not given us an entry capability to that endpoint because it doesn't know what protected payload we want. So the convention is that this initial endpoint, which came to us during fabrication, right, has endpoint ID 1, I think. And what we have to do is give it an appropriate protected payload and fabricate an entry capability to it. That's what's happening here. Now, if any of these things fail at any point, notice that it's a long conjunction of logical ands. If any of these things fail, we're going to call this very nondescriptive procedure exit gracelessly. Exit gracelessly is pretty draconian, okay? It basically says, okay, try to tell somebody what happened. That might or might not succeed. Depends on how graceless a state we're in. And then, and by the way, this return is a lie because this procedure does not return. Here's what we're trying to do. Or at least, remember the situation is, somebody attempted to fabricate us and we have just failed to be fabricated. We'd like to tell them that we failed to be fabricated. Fortunately, we failed to be fabricated, and there's a little bit of delicacy that we need to destroy ourselves, but we need to get a last message out after our death. If you have an estate attorney, this is what they're for in your life. We don't have estate attorneys in the Kyoto system. They're too expensive. So what we do instead is we arrange for the space bank to give us a little bit of help. There's a call you can make on a space bank that says, destroy the bank! Destroy everything that came from the bank, that would be us. And when you've done all that, send this here error code, this here capability, the one that if all had gone well, I would have done a normal reply to. We're exploiting the fact that the space banks are actually implemented by the same process. So by the time we get to the space bank, it can destroy a bank, and it's really only destroying an internal data structure. So it's standing in a position to do this last reply. And what will happen here is we will report to the guy who attempted to create us what was the last error code we got. Now, that might not actually be the right thing to report. It's not clear that we should be exporting to this poor loser the particular action that killed us. It might be that the right answer is, at this point, could not initialize. We weren't that careful here. So this destroy bank call is a little tricky because it's got this side effect that it is destroying all the storage from which this process came. And that includes its data space, that includes any of its temporary storage, that includes the process structure, it's everything, it's all gone. And the reason we use this particular mechanism is it's the easiest way to make sure that the process is fully and finally dead. Right? Think of this as the stake through the heart attached to the garlic, okay? Although there's an interesting problem with doing that. All right. So on the other hand, if we get past that, now we're ready. Yeah.
Is that the process?
No. Okay. So the protocol is, if I'm fabricating a new process, step one is I allocate a new subbank because I want to have something I can pull the ripcord on. I pass that subbank to the constructor. All the state associated with the new process will be allocated from that subbank. The bank that we just created, that we just called to commit seppuku, is that subbank. It is the case, however, That as a matter of common convention, yes, all processes have have access to the prime bank. They have a very peculiar capability on it. It's a capability that imposes a limit of zero allocations. That's used to allow one bank to identify another. Effectively, the only operation you can do on it, it's zero limits, non-destroyable, lots of other constraints, so that by the time you're all done, the only operation you can actually do on it is the identify operation, and that's the reason that you want it to be held. Here's why that matters. Suppose I could hand you a source of storage. It implements the space bank protocol. It claims to be a space bank. How do you know? Does it matter? Well, if it's not a real space bank, guess what? I could be front-ending the space bank, and I could be peeking at every piece of data storage you allocate. If you're trying to implement something for which privacy matters, you actually want to know that the detail of the space bank contract, that everything you allocated from it is exclusively held at the moment that you get it. That's how you know I can't read it. So if I could forge the space bank, there would be a problem. Runtime contracts here are working fairly hard to make certain kinds of forgery hard, if we can, and possible. That's a statement where I start to get into fistfights with people on the GNU Herd mailing list, because their belief is, nope, all this stuff should be replaceable. And my view is, there are some lies that my program should be able to detect you telling me, because there are things I need to protect in the world. And their answer is, well, there are other architectures for getting that. There might be. They have some very plausible stories that there are. Until I've seen those stories sort of fully elaborated in an operation, I'd prefer to stick with something I know works. At this point, we've managed to get through all of the initialization problems, barring a kernel error, that we need to deal with. So these next few INBs and OUTBs are hitting magic numbers that have to do with the MDA display register set that are basically telling it, here is more complicated. There's a memory window onto the display hardware. You tell the display hardware within that window where the base of the display should be for rasterization purposes, and you have to tell it where the cursor is. And that's basically what's going on here. We didn't see the cursor in QEMU because QEMU doesn't actually implement the cursor correctly. And then we clear the screen, which is a fancy way of saying we write spaces to all of those locations. And then we put a couple of test characters out because that was the fastest way to see if anything was happening at all. Message is a statically initialized character string. That's the one that has the Achtung bit. It's up at the top of the C file. And the last part of this, very important because you won't get any more messages if you don't do this, is you send back to whoever created you an Android capability that they can then use to invoke you. And I know we've hit the hour and a half boundary. Give me no more than 5 more minutes and we will break. And then I'll come back and continue. Okay, let's look at main. Note that if initialize fails, we in fact will never return 0. It's not clear to me why this is here, because if initialize fails, we will not make it out. We will have already committed seppuku. You will not get an urn from the dead process. If we make it through initialize, the next thing that's going to happen is we will start processing requests, we hope. And that's what I want to deal with when we come back. That is the server environment, right? This is the IDL environment structure. So when we come back, let me start in on process requests, which is uglier than we might hope. But to anticipate it, what happened, which I will not try to show you, maybe I should. Capital has a mode in which it will generate a template program. This is a program that's basically most of what you need to do for a simple server, plus whatever your specific initialization code is and the actual implementations of your methods. A lot of what we're going to see in the rest of this file is generated by the template generator. How many people, I'm trying to figure out if I can very quickly print up Text Console. So roughly how many people do we have? 5, 6, let's see if I get lucky. I will try to do that during the break. Good. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. Yeah. The fact that it put the IO perm capability into its IO address space early in the initialized logic. So, yeah, there's a kludge here, and it's not something that we particularly love. On the x86, there is an IO permissions bit mask. But there's no way to virtualize it. There's no way to map it. So the problem here is that it's a real pain in the neck to implement that, and we have chosen at the moment to basically say, look, the authority to do I/O operations to ports is all or nothing at the moment. And so think of the I/O perm capability as an address space in which all I/O ports are legal. I would actually prefer not to do that. The question is the right mechanism for constraining I/O ports to use the hardware permissions bitmap? That's one option. Or is the right mechanism to use essentially a binary instrumentation system that that the program cannot circumvent, that essentially constrains the I/O port mechanism in software? There are advantages to the binary instrumentation approach. In particular, there are cases of hardware where if you do not write the correct registers in the correct order, the state machine in the hardware goes into an awkwardly undefined state. On most hardware, those states are recoverable if you know the right incantations. On some hardware, they're not. It's not enough to say, also, you have things like DMA engines where merely knowing what ports can the process write to is not good enough. If the process can write physical addresses that it doesn't have the authority to write, it can overwrite the kernel. So to actually effectively restrict I/O access, you actually have to have a model of what the chip is, and you have to run that model in some sense as a co-procedure with the application that's manipulating the chip. Because if the chip has the authority to write the I/O registers that set up DMA, you need to know that that's what it's doing so that you can range check the DMA that's being asserted. Now that's way beyond what you can do with the port bitmap. And that's why I think we're leaning towards the emulator, the binary instrumentation approach for dealing with I/O port restrictions. But once you get to the position where you say, well, I have to have the I/O port mechanism, the emulator mechanism, it's not clear why I should even try to do anything fancy with I/O port because I've already got a stronger mechanism in place. So, okay, good. Let's break for 10 minutes. Let me get textconsole.c printed or attempt to, and we'll come back.